Beyond Brunel, exploring the future of infrastructure from ICE Southwest and the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership.
Welcome to Beyond Brunel. Hello, I'm Claire Gibson, and I'm really pleased to be joining Beyond Brunel as one of your new presenters.
And I'm Katie Toms, also new to the presenting team and very excited to get started.
We're coming to these conversations from two different angles,
which we hope will mean a richer discussion in every episode.
My background is planning and economic development. I'm a director at CRG Consultants, and my focus is strategic and long-term.
And I'm very much on the civil engineering and delivery side, how things actually get built. I work for WSP as the regional delivery lead in defence and security for the south of England.
So we're your new presenting team for what's set to be a great series with plenty of thought-provoking conversations ahead.
All grounded in infrastructure challenges and opportunities across the southwest. So, let's get started.
Today we're talking about the role of public attitudes in shaping regional infrastructure.
This can spark strong debate, especially in a region as diverse as the Southwest, where local impacts often sit alongside wider regional benefits.
Understanding how people feel about infrastructure is becoming increasingly important, especially in the face of change.
So, how do we build trust, communicate clearly, and encourage positive behavioural change?
We're joined by Pippa Gibbs-Joubert, Associate Director at Copper Consultancy.
Pippa, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Katie.
Before we jump straight into the topic, can you just tell us a bit more about what you do?
Yeah, sure. I work at Copper Consultancy. We're communications and engagement consultants specifically for the infrastructure and development industry, so supporting projects in building consensus and engaging with the public and stakeholders. As part of that, I'm working with Southwest Infrastructure Partnership to develop a report on public attitudes to infrastructure and net zero in the Southwest.
To start us off, why do public attitudes matter so much when it comes to infrastructure projects?
I think there are two reasons, really, and they both relate back to the deliverability of projects. The first is around consensus. There's never been a more challenging time to work in infrastructure. We're dealing with almost triple crises, so cost of living, climate change, and biodiversity loss crises. And while infrastructure delivery is key to solving those problems, there's also an incredibly difficult balance to strike as we do so. And we're living in a really politically febrile time. There's a wide divergence of different views and values and behaviours out there. So threading that needle is really important. And frankly, that means consensus is quite tenuous. So public views in that can really impact decision making. Even if you're working on a major infrastructure project, like a development consent order, where the question for the public isn't really about whether we deliver the project, but more about how we deliver the project, actually, if you don't have consensus around that project, and you've got a really well-organised opposition to it, you can find yourself in a situation where they're pushing budgets, timelines, and ultimately, with some really high-profile cases that we've seen in recent years, those projects can be cancelled altogether because the political will just isn't there anymore. But increasingly, especially with devolution, we're seeing more and more decision-making and investment happening locally. And with the local planning system, it's much more about public acceptability. I've seen projects, I've been brought into projects after they've perhaps failed the first time because there wasn't enough public acceptability around a project. And then you're starting from square one because you've already got a project that has a bad reputation. So first you've got to fix that reputation, and then you've got to build trust, and then you can have a constructive conversation, really. And if you start that too late and you don't consider what people's needs and priorities are, then you're really, the risk is around project timescales and project budgets and ultimately deliverability, I suppose.
So Pippa, from your experience then, what are the common hopes and concerns people have when new infrastructure is proposed in their local area?
Well, really, it's all about what they can see and feel and touch. So the top three reasons people would support an infrastructure project are better health and well-being, better facilities in their community, and better and more access to jobs. In terms of trade-offs, and drawbacks to delivering projects, there are two main concerns. One is about financial impacts, as you might expect, and then the other is about harm to the local environment, the beauty of people's views. Those two things are interlinked: impact on house prices, having to pay more in taxes and levies, and also paying for services related to that infrastructure as well. So those are the concerns, really. So again, all of that relates back to stuff that impacts people's everyday lives. They don't think in terms of the wider regional economy. They don't think in terms of decarbonisation more broadly.
Yeah, how they impact day to day.
Precisely, yeah.
So we sometimes see strong support for ideas in, let's say, a policy around net zero. But then when it comes to seeing a proposal that involves local change, there's some hesitation. I mean, the classic phrase is obviously NIMBYism, not in my backyard. I just wondered why you think that gap exists between that principal policy.
Yeah, that is a really good question, and it's something that's always fascinated me. So I recently did some research into public attitudes to infrastructure and net zero in the Southwest, and we dug into this. And I think there's a step in between the face value policy and then deliverability in that area, and it's around values. So I think it's three things we need to look at there. On the face of it, you ask people, do you support the net zero agenda or not? Around 75% of people in the Southwest say, yes, I do. And you think, great, this is a popular policy, on we go, let's build a wind farm or something. But then we reframed it and we asked people to answer, give a statement relating to support or a lack of support. The first one was, yes, the UK should lead on net zero, be a global leader in investing in net zero technology and decarbonisation. And then the second question was, the UK should invest in other things. No matter how much we decarbonise, we're not going to change much anyway. We're not big enough to do so. So two quite legitimate answers to that question. And when you ask it like that, it's actually a divide of about 50-50. Half of people say, yes, we should be leading on this. We should be investing. We should be a global leader. The other half are saying, what difference is it going to make? We're already struggling on so many fronts, which is fair and legitimate. And then you get down to, OK, well, we're going to do a decarbonisation project in your local area. And that's when it really challenges people, and people do start thinking about not in my backyard. And the reasons that I can see why people don't support it are twofold. The first is around understanding, and you've got particular narratives, without wanting to get political, going on about the cost of net zero, both on people's purses, but also in terms of challenging the world as we know and love it. And people think, oh, I don't want that, because they feel left behind, which links to the second point, which is that there's a really big values question in the question about whether or not you support net zero. It's about what you want to see from the world. And as I say, lots of people do feel quite left behind. They feel the government isn't looking after their needs and priorities. They feel like there has been a huge amount of change in the last decade or so, and lots of it has cost them dearly. So the idea of more change, where they can't see what the benefits are to them, is giving them real fatigue and even fear about it. So I think there's actually a lot of fear about delivering net zero. And then you get round to delivering a project which might change the landscape when they look out the window. It might make a big mess. It will almost certainly cause some disruption somewhere along the way. And just the fact that it is decarbonising our economy isn't going to mean anything to them in terms of their day-to-day lives, whereas all that mess and disruption definitely will. So they really need help in seeing the tangible day-to-day benefits in order to get behind a project in their local area.
So Pippa, your research highlights some clear generational differences. What stands out to you about the different age groups and their thoughts around infrastructure and climate change?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we've got to distinguish between delivery of infrastructure and net zero. It seems like when it comes to infrastructure, understanding is much more closely linked to support. So generally speaking, the more people understand a project, why it's needed, what the benefits are, how it works and what it means to them, the more likely they are to support it. We do see some correlation between different age categories in that regard, but probably only because there's more understanding amongst the better informed of us. And as we've seen, it does seem as if younger people are slightly better informed about these things, particularly kind of the young professionals kind of age. But generally speaking, if people understand a project, they see how it works, they'll get behind it.
Yeah, so what you've just said tells us that clear communication and engagement are really important to help people understand why it is we're considering a particular project, let's say. I'm interested to know what good engagement really looks like, but I'm also conscious of a Southwest Infrastructure Partnership workshop I went to recently. I had a couple of very, well, a lot younger than myself on the table, and they clearly engage in a very different way. So our traditional methods of doing consultation, I wonder whether they need to be adapted to be able to accommodate that younger age group you've talked about that have that longer visibility into the future.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there, Claire. It's actually really staggering. As a concept, it's not. You won't be surprised that more people use social media in younger generations than in older generations, but it was so clear. Almost no one under the age of 35 received their information through traditional channels. It was almost exclusively social media, peer-led platforms, and alternative channels. Whereas almost no one over the age of 55 consumed their media any other way but through traditional means. So you've got a real generational divide there. There's obviously crossover between people aged 35 to 55, but there is such a clear divide. And as an industry, I don't think we're very good at engaging on social media. I also think there's a psychological point around a lot of people don't think that consultation or indeed public discourse full stop is actually for them. You could talk about politics in the same vein, people voting, for example. You see really low voting turnouts and you see people not engaging in a consultation because they don't think it is for them. And that has probably got to do with a lack of trust, to be honest, a lack of faith in the process. People don't necessarily think that if they put time and effort into responding to something, that those needs are going to be listened to. So the onus is on us to A, convince them to engage with and take interest in this in the first place. But when we've done that, to show them how we've listened to them and come back and close that feedback loop. So we have to start moving away from the transactional nature of a consultation. We need to start engaging early. We need to ensure that actually the public are helping to shape a project's objectives from the very outset. And then we need to treat that as a two-way dialogue throughout the development of the project. Because if we don't, then we're not going to be able to build any faith in that process. And we need to empower people. People need to feel that we are building and shaping this infrastructure with them. We're doing it with them, not to them. So there's a few points in there. First, we've got to change the way people think about it. And that comes down to our channel strategies. I don't know if you know, but in marketing, they talk a lot about the 12 touch points between initially coming into contact with a brand and actually making a purchase. And you could compare that to this in a way. People have to experience or be exposed to a project 12 times. One might be on Instagram, another might be on a poster they walk past, another thing might be a pop-up stall in a supermarket, another thing might be a radio or Spotify advert. And all these things come together and has to be in language that they understand about what this project might mean for them before they are driven to take a picture of that QR code, open up the website, and then they've got to be able to look at it and go, ah, I get what this project's about. And then they've got to be able to look at it and click on the bit that's interesting to them and be able to leave a comment. And we need to be confident about our feedback processes being good enough that if they only want to spend 2 minutes saying something about some traffic lights somewhere, that's okay. We've caught it. We've recently had big changes to our planning process. Obviously, the Planning and Infrastructure Acts come in. And that's removed a lot of the statutory duties to consult. You two will know better than me about the terminology there. But I see that as a real opportunity to think, instead of go, okay, we've got these statutory duties, we've got to produce a feedback form that looks like this, we've got to produce 2 rounds of consultation that look like these with these specific stakeholders. Instead, we can think about how do we actually talk to the public to ensure that we've got a solid and representative enough feedback base that we can design a project that truly reflects the needs of the people this infrastructure is designed to serve. So that means we can be much more user-focused. We can think a lot more like corporate organisations, like brands who have been doing this for donkey's years and doing it really, really well. And we can learn from them. I'm not saying it's more work. In fact, in many ways, it's less work. It's just about getting it right from the outset, simplifying our messages and ensuring that actually what we've got in terms of our content is plain English and people can relate to it.
Beyond Brunel, exploring the future of infrastructure. From ICE Southwest and the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership. Follow us on LinkedIn to join our growing community.
And what happens if we don't get this right now? You know, what happens if we don't have that, sounds like more continual engagement with the public through the life of a project and we leave it all too late? What are the consequences?
Well, I think you end up, and we're quite used to the consequences in infrastructure, if I'm completely honest, I think you end up with a really narrow feedback base of people who are already quite well informed, more likely to be opposing, more likely to have time on their hands, which probably means they're a little bit older, not that there's anything wrong with that. And those views are just as legitimate as anybody else's, but it means you don't get to see the full picture. And in the past, I think that's kind of been all right. But because, as I said before, we're living in such a politically febrile environment where decisions are being made and then gone back on, and we've kind of got an undulation in terms of our policy approach at a time when local government is struggling to reorganise itself, devolution is taking hold, the whole planning system is changing. What it really risks is the deliverability of the infrastructure that's absolutely vital to ensure that we can decarbonise our economy, that we can empower local communities, that we can rebalance and recalibrate the cost of living crisis so we do have more social equity. Infrastructure is kind of key to whether people realise it or not, their well-being and their opportunities in life and those of their children. And a failure to deliver that does impact general levels of public discontent moving forward and generally the political mood of the country. So, you know, the risks, the impacts of the status quo kind of remain the same as they've ever been. But the risks around maintaining that status quo in terms of big picture, I think, are really increasing and quite quickly.
So, Pippa, we've already mentioned trust, but really how important are trust and transparency in decision making, you know, particularly where projects do involve disruption and long time change to people's lives?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's the whole thing. It's the whole thing. Ultimately, the infrastructure projects that we're looking at have the capability to completely rewrite the economic, cultural and physical story of a place. And these are people's homes we're talking about. You know, so actually we owe it to them to be respectful, evidence-based and collegiate as we move through that process. I touched on it before, but people really have to feel they're involved in the conversation about it. At the moment, I think people feel so disenfranchised and they don't think that public discourse is really for them. So we have to get people thinking differently about that. And that starts with genuinely and demonstrably listening to their feedback, incorporating that feedback into design, and taking the time to show people how they've shaped those outcomes.
Just looking ahead then, what could infrastructure planners and policymakers do differently, do you think, to build stronger and more enduring public support? Are there good examples out there that we should be following?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure about examples, but I think there is something that we as an industry could be doing, that policymakers could be doing. And it comes back to something I touched on before about long-term disenfranchisement, if that's even a word, but long-term feeling amongst communities that they're disempowered, that they're disenfranchised. I think we need a behavioural change campaign around people's involvement in the public conversation. I think if we're going to succeed, there is two things we need to do. The first is we need to get people engaging with infrastructure projects. As I said before, there are so many sophisticated tools at our disposal that we know are highly effective because we see them in the world of marketing and branding all the time. You can engage meaningfully on social media. You can cut through the noise. It's easy and it's not terribly expensive to segment audience perspectives and sentiment and beliefs and values and behaviours and design messaging and content that specifically speaks to their needs and priorities. And I think that's a long-term thing that local government, maybe even central government, certainly the infrastructure industry really needs to be thinking about. How do we get people predisposed to engage with infrastructure projects? And how do we get them feeling that that will make a difference? How can we build trust in that regard? So that's one long-term thing that I think the industry and policymakers should be thinking about. The other one is around the net zero narrative, which has the biggest PR problem. It is so stigmatized. So I think we need to get much better at articulating those benefits in the first place. But then, and this is the bit that no one's talking about, taking people on a journey and linking that back to net zero and making people associate all those benefits that they want to see in their everyday lives with net zero or decarbonisation or whatever we want to call about it, so that we can reclaim that net zero narrative and we can make it something positive that feels real to people, that reflects their needs and priorities in their everyday lives. So that's quite a journey. But we've got to do it because otherwise we're going to be skirting around this issue for a long time and it's going to come to a head.
Do you think that's something that can be done at a local level or does it have to be done nationwide?
I think we can lead by example down here. You need to start somewhere, don't you? And in our little corner of the country, there is quite a willing audience and there are people who are prepared to listen. And there is openness to these ideas. And we have the opportunity to get that story straight. We have a huge and varied landscape in terms of socio-demographic backgrounds. And we've got everyone from people who are feeling completely isolated and left behind to a really strong, well-informed, hopeful younger generation who do tend to be quite progressive in their views. And we've got everyone in between as well. So if we can get it right here, maybe we can set an example to the rest of the country.
That would be good.
Wouldn't it?
Challenge set.
So finally then, Pippa, on the back of that one, from your perspective, in a way of, you know, leading from the front in the Southwest, what's the single biggest thing that we can be doing to help communities feel that infrastructure is being done with them and not to them?
Talk to them early and on an ongoing basis. And help them to shape objectives and keep that conversation going. Even if people seem to hate it and hate you, have faith, keep talking to them and keep empowering them to make a difference. We've just got to keep trying, I think.
And given you've been saying we've got to adapt our ways of communicating and engaging, that sounds like something that can be done on a regular basis. You know, the days I think of having a public exhibition in the village hall once in a project's lifetime might be done.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think we've got to take a really tailored, targeted approach to engagement. We need to look at the very sophisticated data that we've got on our fingertips. It's very good in terms of helping you to understand sentiment, values, behaviours, etc. And it is possible to look at your target audiences, overlay it with census data or the indices of multiple deprivation data that came out only last year, and look at that and think, okay, we know what views these people are predisposed to having, and designing content and digital spaces.
Pippa, thank you for a really interesting conversation about how we can bring people with us on the journey to more sustainable and resilient infrastructure.
And if you'd like to learn more, download the Southwest Vision Action Plan 2030 from the SWIP website, which includes much more on this topic.
But for now, goodbye.
And we'll see you again soon.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from ICE Southwest and the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership. Follow us on LinkedIn for the latest updates. Beyond Brunel is presented by Claire Gibson and Katie Toms, a Fresh Air Studios production.